Social Services will come to order. A quorum is present consisting of the Chair, Senator Moss, and Senator Halper. Gentlemen, there is before you a draft community substitute which is an outgrowth of some of the committee meetings and informal discussions which have taken place in and around the Senate all week. The principal matter is that the references to the private sector, except for visitors and patients, waiting rooms and restrooms, laboratories and offices associated with dental care and healing arts, waiting rooms and hospitals are removed. We also pick up the and include the vehicles and waiting areas for at airports and other vehicles and public transportation, but the private office or private storage is deleted. So that represents one policy question before the committee. The next thing I would bring to your attention is that the draft does not include restaurants as a place where, as places where either a no smoking section must be provided or some other steps are taken to assure an area for eating free of secondhand smoke. That is another policy question which could be inserted by the committee, and I'm advised that some states do that. And for example, in Michigan, cover food service establishments having a seating capacity of 50 or more persons. Michigan law says in those that such establishments shall post a sign at the entrance of the dining area indicating the availability of the non-smoking area. Whether the 50 person limitation is constitutional or not, I'm not sure, but that's what they do in Michigan. The Michigan law goes on to say that upon the request of a patron, the establishment shall seat the patron in a non-smoking area which shall be clearly marked by sign. As I say, nothing like that is in the draft, but it could be included on the motion. And then another matter to consider is that Legislative Affairs draftsman has some question about penalties. And specifically that there seems to be a difference in the bill between a fine based on a civil complaint or a citation from a peace officer. The civil fine is not less than $10 nor more than $50 under Section 6, and those schedules do not apply in Section 7, where there's an upward limit of $50. So those two may be brought into harmony if we follow the advice of drafting agents.
Mr. Chair, just for form, I would move that we adopt this as a working document.
Objection.
Senator Moss objects. Do you want to speak to this?
Mr. Chairman.
The motion is to adopt it as a markup vehicle, not as reporting on it.
I understand. But I don't believe we're even starting in the right place as a markup vehicle with this. This thing has gutted. From what I can determine on this short look at it, it's probably gutted the intent of the original bill completely.
Well, let me say this. I think that many people would feel that way. Some of the advocates of the original bill, of the House passed bill, have met with senators who were known to have concerns about the direction of all these bills. And I was advised by Senator Ray to go, for example, that the Lung Association said it would reluctantly agree to the deletion of the coverage of the private offices based on its perception of what the political realities are. There's both a substantive judgment and a political judgment to make here.
Well, that may well be, Mr. Chairman, but I would point out that I think recently we just lost a case in court on a state employee, for example, that's in an office. Well, this bill here has amended the draft of it. Will that protect that employee? Will that prevent us as state employers from getting into another lawsuit and losing it?
Senator Huff.
Senator Moss, page 1, line 28, includes place of employment, building, or other structure, a portion of them owned, leased, or operated by the state or by a political subdivision of the state. It does cover that as a prohibited place.
Senator, I hope you won't take this personally, but you are a late convert to this no-smoking church, and you are giving a sermon on your first day in church.
And that's what it boils down to. When I got liberated and I got saved all the way.
I understand. Let's act then on the pending motion, which is to accept the draft Senate committee substitute for purposes of markup. Senator Moss objects. Those in favor indicate. Opposed.
For purposes of markup, yes. As long as we direct it more back to what we originally had in the original bill, I feel much more comfortable.
All right. Then before us, without objection, is the draft called Senate CS for House Bill number 84.
Senator. You brought up a legal question of can you discriminate between restaurants, for example, by size. When you do get to a size where it's possible to make that differentiation, I don't have a problem with making the differentiation. I guess it's a legal question that you need to enlighten me on.
Well, I haven't found any cases, or really haven't looked for any cases one way or the other, but I just thought about it. And I do note that this is done in Michigan and probably elsewhere too. But I don't know if it's been tested in Michigan. The problem I have with it, and I talked about this on the telephone with Legislative Affairs, with Mr. Barrier, is that it does not seem at first blush to be a rational classification. In that the larger establishment may have the opportunity as a business matter to designate an area for non-smokers, and there's that to be said. But the air, the health hazard to an eater in a place with less than 50 people may very likely be worse than in a large facility. So it seems to me to be a demarcation line that is defensible politically, but not from an equal protection point of view. I'm willing to do it because I don't know what the outcome would be, and I don't know if it would be tested. I'm personally willing to do it, but I think we should be aware of that question.
Would it be defensible just based on the economic burden, in that a larger establishment has the ability to designate smoking versus non-smoking without a major economic impact either in cost or anything else, where a smaller establishment may not have the physical size to be able to do it?
Well,
I don't know. I'm just...
Do you have any information? You might call Mr. Hyde and ask him while we're talking and say that the question...
This is Richard.
All right, I have a quotation from Mr. Hyde. But this is not to do in the restaurants, right?
It's to do with restaurants, not the size of restaurants, but whether or not we could include restaurants, whether they're private or not.
Well, why don't you explain what you think this means?
Let me explain it to the committee.
Yeah, explain it to the committee.
Oh. He felt that it was kind of a problem legally with including some kind of private businesses and not others, but felt that if it did come to court, that we could argue on the public health matters related to smoking around food, that you could justify separating out retail food stores and restaurants from other kind of businesses in regulating those as far as smoking and non-smoking. I did not talk to him about the size of the restaurant.
Okay, would you go ask him about that? In your packet, you have the Minnesota law, which defines public place to include restaurants, retail stores, offices, other commercial establishments, public conveyances, education facilities, hospitals, nursing homes, auditoriums, and meeting rooms. And we'll ask Mr. Hyde for his opinion on the Michigan approach. Pending word on the equal protection issue, would the committee prefer to include all restaurants and places where food is served, to leave the draft as it is and not refer to restaurants? Or would the committee prefer to cover only those establishments that serve 50 or more, or some other number?
Suggestion that we should include all of them.
Include all of them.
Because that seems so small, and it's worse than big.
I suppose the question comes up that, and I just ask this, whether the one-room hamburger joint is going to designate an area as a non-smoking area, or can do so, which is a question for you. Of course, the answer is that they can say no smoking in this establishment. That's the answer, but that's economically viable.
Well, it's not just the economic viability in that kind of case I question. That's probably the guy that hasn't got any state-supported loans, hasn't got any state anything else, and pays his own taxes, and he offers a portion of his property to the public under limited terms. If he were a Japanese restaurant, he might say no shoes. If he were in an area where there were a lot of kids on the beach, he might say you can't be there without shirts. And that's one of the conditions under which he offers that limited area for the public. You know, it's kind of hard to define what's public property when we try to define it in this bill. It's like we're saying that you can pay taxes on it, but it's public because you offer it to the public under limited circumstances. And I kind of have a problem with that. The guy himself that runs the one grill hot dog operation in the end of a trailer may be a smoker. And I think we're saying by law that he can't smoke. And I think he has less option than the economic forces do of people who don't want to eat where they're smoking to go to someplace else. That's where I had the initial problem. If he's got an option, if he's got the size to have an option, I don't have a problem. But if he hasn't got the size to have an option to be able to comply, then I think we're infringing on the right to his property, and I don't think we should do that unless we intend to pay the taxes and provide the cost.
I apologize for coming late. You're talking about restaurants. You're only talking about the serving area, because he's precluded by law not to smoke in any prep area now. So you don't need that.
Well, some of them, the guy sits out there, he cooks the food, and then he goes and sits down at one of the tables and has a cigarette.
Out front?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And another issue is the grocery store issue, which we haven't talked about. I find in talking with senators, pretty good concurrence that there should not be smoking in supermarkets and grocery stores. No, I don't think so.
I think it's out. That was one of the things I was looking for.
Now, again, Mr. Hine seemed to say that we may have some problem distinguishing between some private sector businesses and others, but this appears to be done, and the foodstuff argument and the fact that you have to go to a grocery store to survive unless you're a subsistence user would appear to have some justification.
Again, I think it does, if there's size to make compliance possible, but I come back to the
I know that in a grocery store situation, there would not be a smoking area.
If we define grocery store to be what we traditionally look at as a grocery store, but if we define a grocery store as to any quick stop that happens to have groceries, then you're back to the little teeny store with the one person that owns it, and you're telling him what to do on his property himself as a proprietor.
Well, it comes back to the old business. We had what we call a sink rebellion one time along the highway. It had to do with something similar to it. And it had to do with sanitation within the restaurants and things along the highway. I never got sick from anything on any of the old roadhouses, but I guess I was as hot as anybody else if we had to have three sinks instead of two. They prevailed, and I don't object to it. Actually, it's part of the health of the place itself. In fact, the benefit is your sanitation. People, when they go in and they check the place out and they check it, they don't pass sanitation. Is that a violation to their rights to serve lousy food or not? I mean, this is similar. The air in that place is theirs in a sense, and the food in that place is theirs in a sense. And we don't allow them to serve bum food because we shut them up. A good example of that was in a number of salmonella deals that we've had recently.
But there may be a difference, just philosophically, in the cases, because in the sanitation situation, you are talking about, often, you are talking about conditions which are not visible to the customer, which the customer cannot protect himself from, because the customer does not go into the kitchen and see what is going on, or the condition is hidden by artifice from the customer. And the question, in the case of the smoking, that is visible to the customer, and the customer can, you know, vote with his feet normally and walk out and go down the street if he thinks the air is
so that kind of brings up a good point, though. What about the areas that are not regulated? If the argument prevails that don't have the right to go into the interior of someone's small business and tell him what to do, is it legitimate to at least ask him to post smoking permitted, no smoking, so that someone who wants to make the choice and vote with their feet has the option of doing that before they're already sitting down and their dinner is delivered, and then they're going to, you no longer have the right to vote with your feet if somebody comes in with a cigar and sits down next to you.
Yeah, I by the way, one of the proposals was that the state should furnish uniform signs of the no smoking legend, so that there's no argument with the size of the sign and it has the impact that it should have. And I think that's probably a useful amendment.
Okay, I talked to Billy Barrier. He said that he thought it was very reasonable to include establishments that are serving food and retail stores that sell food. He thought both of them were very defensible in court. He said that the court will allow you to be arbitrary with numbers to some extent as long as you have grounds to defend them, but he suggested using square footage rather than seating capacity. He felt he could better defend a square footage definition of the size for a restaurant.
Is that square footage per person or total square footage or what?
Total square footage.
Back to that little one. I thought we were doing something.
Let me see if we can get any help from the audience in terms of just these issues. We know what the policy issues are, I think. I mean, maybe you don't think we do. So I'd rather not have a rehash of testimony advocating one side or the other. But on the issue of whether if we cover food service establishments, we should use a breaking point based on the seating capacity or the square footage, and if we do, what those numbers ought to be. Does anybody have any thoughts? Yes, sir. Will you identify yourself?
My name is Jeff Bowman. Speaking on behalf of the Environmental Lobby Program. It's my understanding that the seating capacities themselves relate to square footage, that building capacities, according to fire marshal standards and so on, typically relate to square footage. And I think that you only have to use the gross square footage of the food service or the food selling area to also have a handle on the capacity of that building. And you can find the appropriate square footage level to meet a patron level if you so choose. And with regard to Senator Halton's concerns in terms of smaller facilities, I think in the case of restaurants, the square footage approach with mindfulness towards what that implies in terms of number of patrons will lead you to a satisfactory solution. In terms of places where food is purchased, we remain persuaded that all such establishments should be designated as non-smoking.
What about the quick stops?
Yes, because in many cases those are the only options available at a given time of day or night.
But what if I don't care about the customer being a non-smoker, but I have some concern about the chap who is working from 12 midnight to 8 a.m. in a quick stop by himself and doesn't see a customer for 3 hours in a stretch and wants to sit behind the counter and smoke a butt. I mean, is there really a compelling interest to tell him that he can't do that on the job if the boss says it's okay?
Maybe under a square footage level, you exempt the employees. Maybe underneath whatever critical square footage level you identify, you exempt the employees because you recognize that in such a small establishment, you have a very limited number of employees, and their relative impact is going to be unimportant.
I think that when we're talking about like the quick stop or grocery stores and so forth, by the way, most grocery stores are now posted in some way to discourage people from smoking in the store, but probably some are not. And I think what we may be talking about thinking of maybe someone being exposed to something that irritates them for an extremely brief period of time, run in and out and so forth. It's not talking a health hazard, is probably not appropriate. And we may be binding ourselves up to a tremendous problem for someone. There is not to. There are people that might elect to. Competitive basis, say we want to have a smoking store of some sort, and so we'll designate it, and if no one other than smokers want to go in there, that's up to them. I would think the competitive nature of things would pull it. I don't really see any need to to mandate it legislatively other than any other store that controls it. If enough people would, of one persuasion or the other, would make it known to the owner or proprietor, I suspect that would have a lot of control over what they do. And as far as restaurants, again, most restaurants of any size have smoking sections and no smoking sections. That's becoming increasingly popular. Again, it might create more problems than necessary.
One more.
My name is Gary Miller. I'm with the Lung Association. I think with all the small towns we have in Alaska, we fall into a situation where there may be just one grocery store. And I think rather than say a non-smoker could win and breathe a smoke for 15 or 20 minutes, a non-smoker may refrain. And if you can't make it 15 or 20 minutes, maybe you can step outside and have a cigarette for a few minutes and then come back in again.
Mr. Cooper?
Yes, if I might, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Cubley, and I represent the hospitality industry. I'd like to commend the committee for their work on this bill and their staff. I think there's been a lot of hard thought that went into this rewrite. And we support the bill as written now, and we hope that you would think very, very hard about putting the section back in that dealt specifically with restaurants. Those are privately owned, just as the other retail stores we have concerns about. And we have no problem with grocery stores, however you want to deal with those in the legislation. But, we certainly think that restaurateurs should be the final judge in what is a smoking section and what isn't.
Does your industry, given the statement that it is becoming an increasing practice to have non-smoking sections, I just was traveling in the lower 48 on official business and encountered that over and over again. If we adopted the Michigan language, which exempted the restaurant with less than 50 people, and of course we're not talking about bars and taverns here, but just food service establishments, would that be a hardship on your industry, given that?
Well, I think that would be preferable to including all restaurants, without a doubt. I think that would save a lot of heartache for the state and the owners of the establishment. But I think that we would prefer just to leave the competitive market to be the judge of what restaurants have smoking sessions.
Yeah, Mr. Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, Mike Miller from Hallis from Juneau. I just wanted to mention that it was said that grocery stores are solving the problem themselves. And as a matter of fact, they are not. When you see the signs that are up in the grocery store, it says that we would appreciate your not smoking or something like that. And I've seen people standing there, you know, smoking cigars, as a matter of fact, right next to the sign. The wording of the sign is that the management is courteously asking the smoker to please refrain, and the action is that the smoker is discourteously refusing to pay the attention to the sign. I think it's going to be meaningful. It has to be in the law. Statements also made that more and more restaurants are coming to this voluntarily, particularly the larger ones. As a matter of fact, unless they changed recently since I've been in them, the three largest restaurants in Juneau, and two of the big hotels and the one on at the wharf, do not have those smoking signs. And I think it is a phenomenon that's becoming more popular across the rest of the country. One reason being states and or cities and or counties have adopted language that mandates it. And I think that is responsible for that very pleasant phenomenon that you perhaps encountered.
Okay,
when we get into the restaurant area and we start talking seating capacity, I get bothered because I see existing health regulations. They go by the seating capacity, but the mistake is often made by looking at the maximum number of seats instead of the maximum number of patrons. So what happens, you penalize a small guy who puts in 50 seats, anticipating he's going to have a lot of business. His maximum may be 25 people, but as a result of that, he's penalized because he has to put in two urinals, he has to put in two commodes, and all these things based on seating capacity. And I've seen too many small businesses when I was with the department penalized, because when the sanitation inspector went in, he would say, hey, you've got to remodel because the code says this. And I think we ought to just forget about seating capacity. When I talked to the folks who came up from the Lung Association and these other agencies, I thought we were all in agreement, both sides of the issue, that Section 8 would cover as the draft of the committee. And I support the committee draft through the subject. I think it's a good working. Both sides seem to be satisfied with that. And then all of a sudden, now I see we want to go back and look at seating capacity and square footage. Square footage doesn't work, because then you get into the thing, and we talk in square footage inside the building or the outside of the building. We ran into that in the Kenai Peninsula School District. There was a big issue over hundreds of thousands of dollars, because what does the state mean by square footage? Are they measuring inside the building or outside the building? Usable square footage, it's a real mess, and I just like the draft, and I commend whoever did this, because I think it's a chronic piece of...
Senator, let me just ask this question, though, going back to the first proposition. Couldn't the small operator in that situation simply reduce the seating capacity to 49 seats and do what he wants to?
No, because I think there's always that expectation that you're going to someday have that kind of business. It's just that way with private enterprise. Just don't see that happening.
Okay, well, we have questions of policy here, and I'm advised that there are questions of policy. It's not a question of constitutionality. I'm told that there's no constitutional right of smokers to smoke in grocery stores or restaurants, and there's no constitutional right of non-smokers to be free of smoke. It's a policy question that we have to decide. And I wouldn't say this on many questions, but my view is not wiser than those of my colleagues on this.
Do we have anything in the draft that requires the owner of a private business dealing with food service or any other for that matter to post at the entrance of the business whether or not smoking is permitted?
No, but we authorize the posting of the sign saying smoking prohibited by law, maximum fine $300, which then has the effect of law if posted.
But we authorize that. We don't require them to say right up front one way or the other.
You mean to put up a sign saying smoking prohibited or smoking not prohibited?
Thank you. Section 5.
Well, only if it's a place where, only if it's in the 300 sections, Nancy, that are the elevator, the vehicle, and the public building.
Right, but that also includes a place of employment in which the owner, manager, proprietor, or other person
posts a sign.
Yeah.
Right, but if he doesn't post a sign, he's not compelled to post a sign.
Oh, okay.
It's just interpretation of Section 8. We're saying, though, that if there's no sign, most is permissible.
Yes.
At which time he puts the sign up, then by law it's prohibited.
Yes.
Right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Isn't it true that for various purposes, shopping malls have been interpreted to be public places? And as I read this, a shopping mall would be excluded, almost specifically excluded. I mean, as specifically as a private bar or anything else was previously.
Yes. The operator of the mall could.
Yeah, but.
Yes.
My assumption is that the operator of a mall, the operator of a grocery store, the operator of a bank is not going to offend people by posting stuff. Mr. Chairman, I am totally dissatisfied with the so-called or proposed committee substitute. I think it emasculates the whole concept of the House bill. Not the whole concept, but a large part of it. I personally cannot support it in its present form. I think that it would be very reasonable to have exclusions listed for places that are bona fidely private, places of small employment, places like bars and liquor stores where the general public does not generally have to use. but a grocery store, a shopping mall, a drugstore, places like that, which the public has to use, I think are in a different category from private establishments. The same thing, sort of places of general employment as against some specific small business, again, can be differentiated. But yeah, I think it all depends on how you define the term public and private. This proposed committee substitute would define public to be only publicly owned. And what I would suggest is that we define public to be publicly used.
Well, Senator, before you arrived, I was explaining that the background of this. First, I raised the question of whether the committee wants to include restaurants or food service establishments. Second problem is that some of the advocates of the House passed bill met with Ms. Dietrich and me and with other senators and indicated that they, with various degrees of reluctance, wish to retreat from the House passed version because of their sense of where the Senate was on this. So we are here trying to accomplish a lot of conflicting objectives in one sitting.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I apologize for not being able to be here earlier and being in on this part, but
yes.
You were asking for expressions of policy.
I'm glad you're very articulate on that. Senator Hopkins.
Far beyond the context of this bill, the definition that you choose for public, being publicly used, is ideologically absolutely abhorrent to me. But that is far beyond the context of the bill. The public directly pays the taxes, then unless it's an absolutely overriding issue, I don't think we've got a right to tell somebody in his property what to do. And that's just the way you express it. We claim overriding public interest in each case.
All right. Let me take the committee in a democratic fashion, small d, through the bill and ask you, first of all, if there are amendments to Section 1 of the bill.
What is Section 1?
Findings. Because, Senator, we adopted the bill for markup purposes, so this is the vehicle for amendment. And it's subject to additions or deletions, which we will see where we are. Section 2. Now, let's see what's
we had a section before where it's really going to smoke out dry food. That's the one.
Yes.
Indoor outdoor
theaters.
Now it's indoor by type.
As a matter of fact, Senator Fisher, the language that you proposed about public use is really the concept of the House passed bill because it talked of prohibiting smoking in areas open to the public. By the way, I had tried to include privately owned places of recreation except bowling alleys. I was told that I couldn't do that.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Could you explain on page 2.5 why we have a less provided otherwise by the presiding judge? I mean, if we're going to go in public structures, none, then why do we allow this figure to say it's okay or nay, yay or nay, when we don't do the first?
That's also in the House passed bill. It's not peculiar to this version. I assume that if you had a six-person jury that came in and said, "We're all smokers, Judge, and we're going to be here for 10 hours, we'd like to smoke," that he or she could say, "Go at it." That's
my reaction is I just wouldn't take that out. I don't think the judge should have that right.
Do you want to move to strike that?
I would.
Where are you?
On page 2, line subparagraph 5, line 6, the phrase is, smoking would be excluded in a courtroom or jury deliberation room unless provided otherwise by order of the presiding judge.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I say that is everywhere else we say state-controlled or government-controlled, it's nay. Then why, again, I'm on the other side of the coin. I just don't think that we should allow the court either.
So the motion is to strike that phrase unless provided otherwise by order of the presiding judge. Is there further discussion?
Object.
Senator Moss objects. Those in favor of the motion, raise your hand.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, sir.
May I explain my objection?
Oh, yes, excuse me.
One of the reasons I suspect that this is in is the very fact that a jury room deliberation is a place where you spend hours confined with yourselves, with smokers and non-smokers. And I suspect that's probably why it's in there, and the judge can say, okay, all of you are smokers or all of you are non-smokers or whatever. And it's due to the fact you're actually confined within a room or a place. Whether you like it or not, by law, you're sitting. Now this, in a way, if we take that out, that means that whether you want to, if you're going to sit there and die a choke to death, hell, the law says you got to.
We might have more hung juries.
In a jury selection process, as told, that was a question that was asked of jurors on trial, whether they did smoke or didn't smoke, just because of the fact that recognize they're going to be sitting together for a long period of time. I don't know whether it becomes a reason to disqualify a juror because he either can or cannot think straight if he does or does not have his nicotine, but it certainly can complicate things.
It could if this is out.
But on the other hand, the jurors can still go to the toilet if he needs to have one that bad. You know, there is an out for the smoker in this case.
I still think we're creating more of a problem by taking it out than we are by leaving it in.
I wasn't opposing the amendment. I was just saying that as far as the jury, it creates all kinds of problems.
On the amendment, those in favor of, since no further discussion, those in favor of Senator Fisher's amendment to strike the phrase unless provided otherwise by order of the presiding judge, signify by saying, raise your hand. Those opposed, the motion carries and the phrase is removed. Now, moving on, are there other amendments to what is Section 2 of the draft? This is the section
Chair,
of Senator Moss.
I still got if I may belabor this point a little bit further. This says a court. That means if you've got a smoking judge up there, everybody's going to be confined in that cotton picking time.
You won't have a smoking judge.
No, we took out the unless.
You can't smoke in the courtroom. And the juror can't smoke.
You can't now.
No. And the this is the section, if it's the committee's desire, where the insertion of grocery stores or restaurants or private places will be made.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still comparing the House bill with the Senate bill. Unfortunately, the versions don't quite mesh.
Okay. The comparison would be between what is subsection 6 on page 2, beginning at place of business, and subsection 8 on page 2 of the markup bill, which begins at place of appointment.
Well, Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, I have not seen the committee propose substitute, so I don't have language ready, and I'm not ready to propose a specific amendment that would cover what I define as publicly used space. I don't want to get into an argument over philosophy or semantics here. In part because of that, I would like to defer action on this until I can come back with an appropriate amendment.
Okay, well, let me do this. We can move on to other portions of the bill. There may be someone else in the committee who would offer an amendment and I can support. Okay. Anybody else want to speak to section two?
Mr. Chairman, one suggestion I would make. Even though on page one, line 19, the title says smoking in certain vehicles in indoor places, it seems to me that on line 23, we should say the vehicle of public transportation and an indoor waiting, because the title will not govern the language of the section.
Objection to that?
Not totally. Thank you.
Let Cheryl will try something on along this line and see what the community is. In section two, if we added, I would propose adding subparagraph nine. And a food service establishment having a seating capacity of 50 or more persons. That is taken from the Michigan law. The food service establishment under another section 320 of this bill could designate a smoking area.
Having a seating capacity of
50 or more persons.
Section
3,
isn't it?
That would be in 9 under section 2.
We have to define food service establishment.
Okay. They didn't do it. I'm speaking of places where food is to be consumed on premise. Saying that if you operate a restaurant with 50 or more seats, you have to have at least a non-smoking area in effect. You can have the whole place non-smoking or you can designate a smoking area.
Is this an eating establishment?
Yeah.
Restaurant? An eating establishment?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we didn't have anything in there in this draft bill.
No,
that included that. So this is actually including another.
It's proposed new subsection 9.
It's taken from section 3.12905 of the Michigan Code.
Mr. Chairman, I'll tell you the problem I have is back to page 5 when you're talking about regulations and it says the department shall adopt regulations. And I can see when they get their hands on it, they're going to go into the small guy who's got 51 seats or whatever. And they're going to say, you got to put a wall physically separate, or you got to do this, and I'm telling you, it's a mess when the department gets a hold of it. I just, they're going to set regulations that the small businessman is not going to be able to afford.
We had a letter of intent on that. Did you understand that? That would, I think, cover your concern.
Well, we took out the crazy standard that was in there.
Yeah, in the House bill, there was reference to the ASHRAE standard of the American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, and Air Conditioning Engineers, which was removed on the basis of testimony that the standards would be difficult to achieve in Alaska in the light of prior construction practices and climatic conditions. And we had a letter of intent. This was when we were talking about something different, but we said. Section 1835.320A provides accommodation to smokers by allowing the designation within an office or other place of business. So we're not covering those in the private sector. But we're going to be covering restaurants. Recognizing that non-smokers may be required to enter a designated smoking area, and that in some instances a complete separation of a designated smoking area from non-smoking areas will not be feasible, Section 1835.320D requires that a smoking area designated must meet minimum standards of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Still, does that still there?
Yeah.
Oh, that's not there, okay. And then we took out the ASHRAE matter, and we went on to say the committee expects that the DEC will encourage wherever possible inexpensive and non-onerous steps such as signposting, physical separation where practical, and the siting of smokers so as to take advantage of existing ventilation systems.
The problem, Mr. Chairman, I have is when terms like where practical, you have a person going in with the department, probably in all sense, never was a small business man, never had to do any of these things, but he goes in with his little bit of book knowledge, and all of a sudden, it will be practical. Now, I've seen a case where one sanitarian went into a business and told a guy in his heating hood canopy that, my God, the rule says it should be a 45-degree angle. Cost a guy $5,000 to change it over. Afterwards, he found out that the system he was using would work in a horizontal plane. But I can see the same thing happening here.
But the department has authority to implement regulations.
But we haven't seen those, Mr.
Wait a minute. But can only implement regulations to carry out the act. There's nothing in the statute that says that they may require physical modifications of a restaurant. It says that they can require that the smoking signs be up, which would mean maybe the height of the sign or the visibility of the sign. But they can't direct physical separation under this draft.
Well, the letter intends a certain physical where practical.
Yeah, and I'm sorry.
Deciding where's practical.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, but that's my fault because that related to the House bill, which we modified in stages.
Well, let's go a little further. Let's just put in the letter of intent that no physical structural changes to existing eating places can be required under this act. If they're required somewhere else, fine, but not, well, we're not giving a new authority to provide any kind of a physical change, a structural change, or no walls, no.
Well, if he wants to, I mean, if he wants to do that for that would seem more
plausible
than that.
I'm not trying to create ventilation systems or walls between smokers and non-smokers, but areas of a restaurant which would be free, which would be smoked, tables which would be smoke-free. Okay, are you ready for the question on this amendment?
Motion stand before.
Yeah, let's take it again. Those who favor that amendment to refer to the food service establishments with 50 or more seats, raise your hands. Opposed? Okay, so we'll add that as a subparagraph. Okay, are there any amendments to Section 3?
Mr. Chairman, I reserve the prerogative of bringing in a further amendment to Section 2.
That's true.
At one time, I can't figure out where it would go if I had to do it. I was concerned that in a public school, for example, that the person in control, the official, either the principal or superintendent, might allow a smoking area for elementary or secondary students. Are we pretty well covered here on the section here that does not allow smoking in public schools?
No, sir. Your concern is not addressed because schools must have our areas where smoking is prohibited, but then in the exemption provision, or rather in Section 320, designation of smoking sections, it would be possible to designate a smoking room or a smoking area.
Well, my point is, I'm not objecting to the teachers or the people that are not members of the elementary or secondary school smoking area for them, but I am objecting to allowing smoking by the elementary or secondary students an area being designated for them. not quite sure.
Then I think if you did it, you could do it in 320B on page 3. Let's see. Yes, yes. Where it says, a smoking section designated under this section shall make reasonable accommodation for the needs of the smokers and non-smokers who use the place or vehicle. You could say, except that the smoking by
minors will not
by minors is prohibited.
Well, no, I would,
according to the existing law.
The amendment that I would make on that, smoking areas in or on grounds of primary or elementary or secondary schools may not be designated for students.
Yes,
that's the point that I'm trying to get across.
You have to smoke them right one on the side.
Well, they can't even do it on school grounds.
Okay. Yeah. Let me make sure we have that. Senator Fisher?
Okay, what we're saying is that there will be no smoking by students in the elementary and secondary school anywhere on the grounds, period.
On the ground or in the building. The point is there are schools in this state today that officials in charge have designated as a smoking area for students. We're not trying to take it away from the teachers that want to go to a smoking area, the authorization to designate a smoking area for those people. The only thing I want to make sure of is that no official, because in the first place, on every dab-burn cigarette machine we got, it says 18 or under, you can't buy cigarettes. So here we've got school officials just designating smoking areas for them.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I concur with this because I see too many times where a school board particularly don't have the guts to say there will be no smoking. So what they do, they say, it'll create a little smoking area here and a little smoking area there, and I agree with what you're saying.
And this is
a lot of you all understand Senator Moss's amendment, which would be explicit about no smoking in schools.
Including toilets.
Well,
for the kids.
Right.
Yeah. Any objection? Not. We'll make that amendment. Okay. Are there any other changes? Nancy, we had a suggestion that the signs be furnished by the state. Can you speak?
Yeah. That was suggested by Ed Hine from Legal Services. He thought that it might be better for the signs to be all the same, that DEC would provide the signs for state-owned and operated leased facilities and for other people on demand. And when we were talking about it, we also thought that perhaps the universal sign, the red circle with the cross, might be a good thing to add to the signs because a lot of people don't speak English.
Says we should speak louder than words.
Yes.
Is that in here?
No.
No, it's not in the bill currently.
You want to require a specific sign?
So the specific signs are required, but it doesn't say where they will come from.
Well, but it also doesn't say that, you know, for example, if somebody's got a log structure and everything log and does it say he has to have a purple sign with orange lettering, or does it say that you can have any sign he makes as long as it's the right size?
As long as it's the right size.
The bill says that.
Yeah.
The proposal is that the state give you the standards.
The state will provide if you want to use it.
If you want to use it, fine.
I got it.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So we could add that the Department of Environmental Conservation shall furnish signs.
So of course, we're sending the bill
request. To furnish signs on request.
On request. People like this will need no
persons desiring to display them under pursuant to this chapter.
This is an unknown factor for that.
Huh?
What's it going to cost?
Maybe the bumper stickers. Maybe the Alaska Lung Association will provide those signs.
Another prison industry is there. Okay.
That's a good idea. How about state the letter of intent?
Prepared by the jails. Any other questions? Is there objection to that?
No.
We'll include that. Then we also had a concern that our penalties. Well, one is a civil fine and one is a criminal penalty. Why can't they be different? I don't think I'm going to worry about it. Okay, anything else? Now, Senator Fisher, you still desire to have an opportunity to offer an amendment on this?
Amendments, yes.
Amendments.
And I apologize for not getting the DOS meeting also.
Okay. Senator Fisher?
Just one question. On page 4, section D, when it says about a person cited, may do the following, you know, they can send it in, it says the amount of bail, et cetera, but shouldn't there be another phrase indicating that they can appeal it or they can do something other than, in other words, they're guilty in both 1 and 2, but supposing they feel that they're not guilty, is there something that they can do on that form when they send it in other than pay it or waive the appearance? There's got to be another thing there that they can say, I want to appear.
Which section are you looking at?
Well, it would be D, line 20 on page 4. And take it on down through to 28. You're talking about mailing the violation, the piece of paper that you get.
Yeah.
And then on 24, they say, well, you can send the bail. Yeah. 26 said you can indicate a right to appearance is waived. What about the right to appear if you don't want to waive it? What do you think?
I'm sure that you can indicate a desire to appear and contest the citation.
I just wonder why specifically they make the assumption you're guilty without.
Well, as a matter of fact, it says, if you look at F, if the person cited fails to pay the bail amount or to appear in court, then it is treated as a summons for a violation. And then the summons, then there are judicial procedures as to how you handle a summons for a violation.
Maybe I don't know enough about law. It just seems to me somewhere there ought to be an X something and says, hey, I don't like what you're doing. I don't want to.
What I'm saying is that would be in other titles. But
normally,
if you don't furnish the bail and you don't waive you don't enter a plea of guilty or not or no contest, then it's treated as a summons for a violation. But we'll look at that again.
Okay.
Sure. Understand this. Okay. Okay, well, let's complete our action on this Friday, then, if we can. And you can post your
Here's his response to that.
Because the extension only says for a driver in the high school, unless you only get a ticket. Center 16, 17 charge for summertime.
No. We're going to proceed now to a consideration of Senate Bill 346 relating to the treatment of mentally ill persons. And in a moment, we'll hear from Dr. Shapiro of the Department of Health and Social Services. It'll just be an easy moment.
I'll stand.
Dr. Shapiro, welcome, and please proceed to discuss Senate Bill 346.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Phil Shapiro. I'm here representing the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. We reviewed the proposed revisions to the current civil commitment law, and we find that the revisions are consistent with what we think would provide for a more secure, safe, and therapeutic situation for both the individual and the community. I've had some experience working on the institutional side and had witnessed how this law works well and doesn't work well. Jim Scholes is here from my office, and he's been following civil and criminal commitment systems for several years in the state, and he's, I would say, quite knowledgeable and expert on some of the workings of the law that I'm less familiar with. I would like to call on him as well to assist the committee in understanding what some of the problems might be or what some of the answers might be.
Are there any questions, Dr. Shapiro? If not, why don't we hear from your next Did you say he was here to answer questions?
Yes. Okay. If the committee has questions, we'll act as a resource.
We've had some extensive discussions of this in Anchorage and Fairbanks before the bill was introduced. We took a lot of testimony. So I don't think that I require very much of this member of the committee. I might say this, Senator Halford, you saw some mail that was opposed to Senate Bill 346. You might discuss it. Pardon?
I didn't get the letter.
What was the gist of the public opinion?
Well, we did get one that said please oppose the API Big Brother Bill.
API Big Brother Bill.
Did you consider this an API Big Brother Bill?
I would say really just the opposite. We have found ourselves in situations where we know a situation is precarious, delicately balanced, where something potentially dangerous or disruptive could occur. And the way that the law is constructed at this time, the treatment team and or the family, the psychiatrist, the mental health professional had no ability to contain that situation because the individual is not committable under the law as it's written at this time. The way that the revisions are worded would give the community and the treatment team, which is working on behalf of the community, to contain a dangerous situation an opportunity to do so. I did not witness in my days at the API a single incidence of abuse of power. On the contrary, I think that because of census pressures, we are forced to release people at times faster than we would like to because we have people coming in the door and we have to therefore move a little quicker than we'd like to, so that people are not being held against their will because the treatment team or the mental health professional wants to do that. And I think, in fact, the opposite is true. So that what these revisions would do would be allow us to maintain a situation a little bit longer to make sure that the insight on the individual side is greater, the medication has had a chance to take, yeah. The community's protected, the individual's protected.
Senator Fisher.
Just one question. Why raise it to 18? Was 14? Why were 18? What's the rationale for it?
Well, the main, there are several considerations there, but the main advantage, I can give you an example where we would have a 15-year-old child who may be quite ill, and that illness may lead to a situation that's dangerous to self or other. Judgment is impaired, and the child may not even be living at home, may be living in the streets. the parent has lost control of the situation. The child is in the hospital, but is not committable under the involuntary section of the law. On the voluntary side, the parents cannot sign that individual in, even when the doctor agrees that that child should be in a contained situation. So that in a sense, the doctor and the family could concur that this individual needs to be treated, can't get him in on the voluntary side, and the child has the power and the decision to walk out of the hospital. And we're just sitting there in awe of how the law doesn't help us to bring that situation under control.
Thank you.
I suppose that what the few people who have expressed concerns are concerned about is the civil liberties aspect. They think that perhaps they'll be overreaching, or people who are eccentric or iconoclastic will be caught up in a web here, even though they don't. They're not in danger to themselves. And I don't really know how to give them reassurance on that, other than your statements.
Well, the first off, I haven't seen it in Alaska. I think that that it is essentially non-existent in the 9 months that I spent in the institution. Secondly, the protection against that is that there is a judge who makes the final decision. It's a professional judgment with the court making the final decision on an involuntary situation. Thirdly, as I stated, census pressures preclude that as a possibility. And fourthly, there's intense peer review and quality control at the institution. And if anybody is out of bounds in terms of their notions on civil commitment one way or the other, there's a lot of work in order to make that individual come into what would be more appropriate. And we haven't really had that problem.
Senator Fisher.
Mr. Chairman, Doctor, you said that you've not seen it in Alaska. Have you seen abuses in other places?
There are some situations that I'm aware of where bad judgment on the part of a psychiatrist or a mental health professional has been in operation, and the laws are then in place to protect from this happening. But fortunately for us at this time, the API is staffed by an extremely high quality group of people, and we're just not suffering from that issue at this time. I think that the law, as it's stated, is very fair to both individual and community, and that given the improvements, we're going to even have a better chance at a therapeutic and a secure situation in this state.
Senator?
Mr. Chairman, you qualified your statement saying that there are no abuses at this time, that there's a quality staff and so on. I have been told of instances where problems of that sort might have existed before. Whether that is correct or not, would you say there's been an improvement that whatever else may have existed before, that we do have a good situation now?
I'm not aware of the history in terms of what you're saying, so I really
I don't want to discuss any specifics.
Yes, well, I'm not aware of any specifics, so I couldn't discuss it, but from the time that I'm aware of the institution, as a staff psychiatrist and then as director of mental health, it's been good, and I think that this will make it better.
How far back does your familiarity?
A year and a half.
Thank you.
Approximately.
Two things. One is there a definition of mentally ill? That there's a standard set somewhere, so, or is it?
Major mental illness, yeah, DSM-3, which is the diagnostic manual that we use, and it's nationwide.
Okay, then I have one other question that when you look on page 4 and we're talking about the discharge of a minor, if, this is again one of those, for instance, that if the parents want to discharge the minor, but the treating physician says no,
the parents override that, or?
Well, that depends. The way this is written, I think it's good, because it offers the physician the chance to go either way, and then throws the decision in the direction of the judge ultimately, if there's combat between the parent and the doctor. But let's just say that the family is in a situation of denial. The doctor feels that there's a major mental illness and there may be some danger there. To the level of seriousness of the situation, the doctor can allow that family member to sign out against medical advice if the doctor does not feel that this is going to be a disaster. All right? You give the family the information that you think that they should have, and you think that the denial will not lead to grave danger, you can let that situation go. On the other hand, if you really do think that there's going to be a tragedy or something gravely dangerous, then you can go into a conflict situation with both family and the child and go to the court situation and present your case. The family, the child, will have their own lawyer, the state, the psychiatrist has its own lawyer, and then that both sides are presented to the judge who then makes the decision.
And that's usually within a short period of time.
Oh, yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Doc.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to be heard on things?
My name is Jim Parsons, I'm manager of the Behavioral Health Division for the Municipality of Anchorage and licensed psychologist. I'm also president-elect of the Alaska Mental Health Association, which studied the bill, and I think through its current president, Dr. Schrader, relayed some comments in on the bill. Our concerns, first of all, agree with Dr. Shapiro that in my 30 years of seeing commitment in Alaska, there were some early instances of communities trying to dump some acting out individual onto API, and they did not meet categories, and so they begin one day and out the next because they did not qualify for that kind of care that some small community didn't have to deal with someone whose behavior was aberrant but not psychotic. But that there are essentially no instances that I'm aware of misuse of the statute in my 30-some years here in Alaska. There was some criticism earlier because Alaska was part of an interstate compact that if you became mentally ill in Alaska and were a resident of Washington, that we would treat that person until they could be adequately transported to their home state. And the same thing if Alaska became ill in Washington. There were those who thought that this was part of a conspiracy to maybe make Alaska a dumping ground for political and mental health patients. And we always have to disabuse people of those kinds of alarms that have been proved to be baseless.
I remember working for Bob Barton when the Mental Health Act was passed.
Yes.
That was the human cry over
the health of the Women's Club of America. Senator Bartlett said that there was more mail received in the federal Congress about the Alaska Mental Health Act than any issue up to that time that they had received mail on, and helped successfully to implement the 1957 law. On page 5, line 3, it says a peace officer or a mental health professional. The Mental Health Association's concern a little bit there was that it might better say a state licensed or certified mental health professional.
There is a definition of mental health professional.
At that point, too, we were concerned because there was some feeling that someone could have a master's degree in child guidance, practically, and not really be a specialist In fact, the licensing for a psychologist is generic in this state, so the fact that one is licensed in psychology doesn't mean that they have skills in clinical psychology. And some social workers might be fine accredited social workers, but have had no psychiatric skill training. There was some feeling that the department at least might set up some kind of standards for mental health evaluators in this process, regardless of whether they were psychiatrists or psychologists or social workers. The last page, line 26-7, says a social worker with a master's degree in social work and experience in the field of mental health. That seems fairly general. One could have been a teacher of teachers on how to have good mental health in the classroom, and it might fit that kind of loose definition there that might be tightened up slightly. The other word that we were a little bit uncomfortable with was the page before on 17, line 7. Concern over imminent danger to the community by a presumed mentally ill person. The word presumed seems to be inexact in terms of what it might imply. But I think he's mentally ill. It's not tight enough, but one should not be acting on it.
Well, I assume that would be a situation, an emergency type of situation, where there had been no recent diagnosis, but...
I'm not sure I'd suggest a better word, but it seems a fairly loose word to be using, inexact in this. By and large, with those few exceptions, the mental health association feels it's a good step and it's an appropriate rewording of our type of step.
Can I see
that? Yeah, it's just better after all this.
Jay Verkozen took the liberty of blasting the authors of the bill, claiming that it would deputize every physician practicing in Alaska with police power to have whomever he or she chooses hauled off to API, adopts purposely vague and sloppy definitions of criteria for psychiatric imprisonment, he says. And he set forth procedures to approve psychosurgery, lobotomy, and other comparable forms of treatment. I think that's in the existing law, as a matter of fact, that we went through this. And I think he knows that.
Yes. I heard his testimony in Anchorage, and most of us that heard it were not in concurrence with his particular views on the thing. We had difficulty following his logic that viewed with alarm the situation as he did.
Okay.
Can I just follow something through? Say we have an emergency situation and a psychologist felt that this person should undergo treatment or whatever, or be put in, say, API. Okay, this same psychologist then would turn, or that person would go to a treating physician. Okay, so a psychologist would never be in a position to determine whether the person should be discharged or not. That would be determined always by a physician.
The system of treatment is such that there's always a physician and usually a psychiatrist who makes that final determination. Maybe on the recommendation of a psychologist who might be a therapist that is admitted to the treatment.
Well,
it should be.
Thank you. It would be my intention, unless anyone else wants to be heard, to try to get both these bills out of here by Friday. And I will have, we'll bring back the matters Mr. Parsons, Dr. Parsons raised, so we can address those one or the other. Is there anything else to come forward with me? No, we'll stand again until Friday.